Shaktulik's, I believe, where Leonard Sepla actually received the serum and turned around to go back. And in Shaktulik, we received the word the night that that we arrived, just before we crossed, that the first snowmobiles had crossed that day. And so if any snowmobiles had crossed, we were going to cross.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello guys, I am back with Jonathan Hayes. We are talking about his Centennial Sepla expedition across the state of Alaska in the winter of 2025. We are talking about the coast onward to Nome, so this last third of the expedition. We're about halfway through our series now. There's been a lot of good stuff here leading up to this. We've talked a lot about leadership. We've talked about expedition planning. We've talked a lot about the Sepala Siberian. Let's jump into this. Jonathan, tell us a quick story about the last third of your expedition.
There are two big stories in the last third. One was the crossing of Norton Sound, and one was the blowhole. So do you want me to just dive into one of those? Or?
I actually have a question about the Norton Sound, so okay. Let's talk about the blowhole.
All right. So as I mentioned before, every time a news anchor or a reporter would ask me what scares me or, you know, what am I most anxious about on the expedition, without reservation before I went, I would answer the coast. I trained at Mitch Seavey's kennel for a winter with Gerhard Tehart, who is still a really good friend of mine. And many will know, you know, it was his life's dream to be an Iditarod musher. And he did, of the 1,000 miles, he got, you know, 50 miles from the finish line. And the blowhole shut him down. And I remember, you know, and he's a tough guy, Special Forces, South African Special Forces, you know, he's the real deal. And I remember him looking at me and saying, you know, he had two broken bones. And he said, Jonathan, I would not have scratched. He said, even, you know, in that pain, I would have continued. He said, I was seriously concerned that I was going to have dogs die if I didn't hit that button. So that was his experience. And, you know, and then, you know, some of us have seen Brent Sass's phone footage of when he got hammered in the blowhole and blown off of a ridge. That's, you know, some pretty harrowing footage. So, you know, I had all this in my mind. My dogs had never experienced anything like that. I had never experienced anything like that. And the first time we had the ice-wind combo was the crossing of Norton Sound. The second time, and the most extreme time, was in the blowhole. Now, they call it the blowhole. It's this area between, was it Topcock Hills? Between the Topcock Hills and Solomon, where the topography just funnels all of this Arctic wind coming down from the north, and it just creates this vortex where there's this 20-mile stretch that, you know, it is like mushing through a sandblaster, and you know, that's on a good day. And so I knew roughly where it was. And we, funny story, we were in the shelter cabin, and this was, you know, the end of the expedition. So, you know, some of our nerves were a little frayed, but you know, we were having a beautiful day coming down out of the Topcock Hills. I say beautiful, it was grueling. I mean, I was running up every hill with my team. You know, we're hauling a lot of freight, and you know, but it was a beautiful day. Everything was going great. But the wind was starting to pick up, you know, as we were starting to descend down toward the coast, and found the shelter cabin, and we went in, and this snowmobiler came from the direction of Nome and was heading toward White Mountain. and he was a native, and he comes in, and when he comes in, I see blisters on his face, and he says, "Which direction you're traveling?" And we said, "Well, we're gonna head towards Solomon." And can I swear on this podcast?
Like, sure.
And I don't swear, but I'm just relaying the story. He goes, "The weather down there, it fucked up," and I could see the blisters on his face, and I was like, "Great." And then as if to add insult to injury, Jeff goes, "What'd you say?" And he goes, and then he repeated himself and said it again. And I was like, "Oh, if a native, who's traveling through here regularly is telling us that it's that bad and he's got blisters on his face, we knew we were in for a ride." So the goal was to push through the blowhole, make it to the shelter cabin in Solomon. That was the goal. There's a
shelter cabin to shelter cabin.
Yeah, there was a Bureau of Public Lands shelter cabin in Solomon. That was our goal for the day. And so then we go down into the blowhole, and it just, every 5 minutes, it's exponentially worse than the 5 minutes before. And it just get, and again, I'm traveling alone. My snowmobilers are way up ahead, and it gets to the point to where I can't see my lead dogs at all, and thankfully my leaders are seeing the iron dog posts that are put out, and they're going from one to the other. My leaders were leading the way in doing that, and then I hear, and I look, and speaking of the iron dog, at this moment in the expedition is when the iron dog snowmobile race caught up with us in the blowhole. So I can't see 20 feet ahead of me, and now I've got snowmobilers flying by me at, they weren't going top speed because they couldn't see well either, but even at 40 miles an hour, and all I've got is a little headlamp on, and it's daytime, but you can't see very far. 40 miles an hour, they hit me. It's game over.
And it's not to interrupt, Jonathan, but this is a very dangerous way to travel in Alaska. Many, many accidents have occurred in this manner between musher teams and snow machine teams, et cetera. Man, that had to have been a pucker factor.
It was. And so, all I could do is just keep plugging forward and hope that we were on the right path. But thankfully, when those iron doggers passed Jeff and Jamie... We're thinking of me, and they were like, "Man, we didn't see them till they were right on us. Jonathan's got no lights on him at all, except for his headlamp. We're going to go back and escort him through this." So I'm about halfway through, and I see Jamie and Jeff pull up, and one of them gets behind me with their snow machine and lights me up. The other one gets in front of me with his snow machine, lights up, so that we don't get hit by iron dog racers. And so they're escorting me, and then Jamie stops and he comes back and he goes, "We're right on top of Solomon Cabin." Now, I've got this app on my phone that's telling me every half mile how far I've gone, and my math and Jamie's math weren't adding up. Something was wrong. And he was like, "We're right on top of it. It's got to be here somewhere." And I was like, "Are you sure?" And we're yelling at each other. We're like a foot away from each other, yelling at the top of our lungs. He goes, "Yeah, it's got to be right here somewhere." And I said, "Okay, well, why don't you go ahead and find it? I'm okay. I'm safe. I'll keep traveling. You go ahead, find Solomon Cabin, and, just make sure we don't miss it in the storm." He goes ahead, and I travel for another half hour or so, and then I see him waving his arms, and I see something, black, looks like a box behind him that, I guess is Solomon Cabin. And so he's waving for us to follow him, and my dogs naturally follow him, so we head in that direction. And the moment we pull up, my dogs just cluster into this big ball. And within 2 minutes, they're starting to be covered in snow. And so I'm trying to deal with the dogs. And Jamie comes over. This was horrible. And I look over at the cabin, and it's not Solomon Cabin. It is a shack, a little trapper shack, that the door won't even close on. That's probably 10 by 12. I mean, just filled with snow inside. It's definitely not a Bureau of Lands, you know, cabin. And this where we're at is horrible. The dogs, though, are shut down. Snow's filling the snow machine motor bays inside the snow machines. So they're having to stop every once in a while to empty them. And Jamie comes over and he's like right in my face. And he's like, "This was a bad idea." And I was like, "What was a bad idea?" And he goes, "We shouldn't have come through the blowhole." And I was like, "What would have been a better idea, Jamie?" And, he said, "You know, we should have stopped at the last shelter cabin." I looked at him and I said, "This isn't Solomon." And that's like when it like really settled in that, like, you know, now it's nighttime. Now we've stopped the team. The team's just shut down. And what are we going to do? And we're gonna hunker down for the night and plug away again. After I bedded the dogs down, tried to feed them. They just wanted to get out of the weather. We hooked up the Starlink, and I reached out to a couple Iditarod mushers, and they both said the same thing. They said, "You never stop in the blowhole."
How far were you away from the Solomon cabin at this point?
We didn't know, but we were probably about 7 miles from Solomon cabin. So, first thing they said was, "You never stop in the blowhole." And I can't remember which one of them said, "I know exactly where you're at. And if you think you're going to wait out this storm, you could be waiting a week. You're going to have to get your team up and get them marching. So as soon as you see any glimpse of daylight in the morning, you need to get your team moving again." So I know I told you that there were some things that I intellectually knew about my dogs, but kept second guessing because of all the horror stories I'd heard from racers with racing dogs. And so the first mistake I made was putting coats on my dogs. Why do I say that? Because I know from even here in Maine, when there's a blizzard, the snow builds up over their coat, it insulates them, protects them from the wind, and they've got this little eco bubble underneath the snow that's protecting them from everything that's going on outside. Well, you put a coat on that, you know, it's made out of whatever kind of fabric that's made out of, the snow cannot build up on that jacket. And so all the snow is just blowing off, which keeps them perpetually exposed, you know, to that snow. And what's worse is the snow is getting up underneath the coat and then melting and refreezing. All of that's bad, you know. But I, you know, had this war in my head at the time, and I was like, "I've got these coats. I'm not going to be lazy and not put them on my dogs. I need to go above and beyond and do the best I can for my dogs. So I'm going to put these coats on them." So that was the first mistake I made in this. The next mistake that I made was, you know, we're laying there, and you know, in this cabin, shivering, and I'm thinking of Gerhardt's words to me that he was afraid he was going to lose a dog where I'm at, you know, and I was like, "Man, you know, I'm a day from Nome. What if I wake up in the morning to a dead dog? Like, I'm not going to be able to live with myself if I wake up in the morning to a dead dog." So I wake up the guys after they'd been sleeping for an hour or so. I was like, "Guys, I'm sorry. Just want to let you know I'm bringing the team in." And they're like, "All 16 dogs?" And I'm like, "Yep, all 16 of them are coming in." And they're like, "Okay." You know, and in my mind, I was just like, "Err on the side of caution. Err on the side of caution." You know, I don't want anything to go wrong. And, you know, I went out there, and my dogs were just nowhere to be seen. And here's how crazy it is. Like, I could see my sled and the snowmobiles when I was walking away from the cabin. But the moment you turn around and look back at the cabin, it wasn't there. That's just how bad, you know, the winds and everything were. Everyone on the team got frostbite that night. So I go out, and I'm looking, and I find the gang line. I grab the gang line, and I lift. And when I lift, the dogs are coming up limp. And I'm like, "Yep, they're dead." I'm like, "I've got dead dogs." They weren't dead. They were conked out asleep. I pulled them out of this beautiful, warm snow cave that they were sleeping in back into this nasty storm. And all of my dogs are looking at me like, really, dude, I was sleeping and you're bringing me back into this mess again. And, you know, I was like, dang it. You know, I was so mad at myself for pulling them out of that comfortable spot that they were in. But the biology didn't lie. You know, the history of this breed didn't lie. They were truly comfortable and at home there. And I was overthinking it. And, but at that point I drug them all out. So I brought them all in. And, which, you know, in some ways I'm glad I did, because there was a lot of snow that had packed underneath their coats, and I was able to get those off and thaw out the dogs. And so the next morning, I told the guys, I said, get your snowmobiles ready, because when I bring out these dogs and hook them up, we're taking off. So they go out, takes them an hour to get their snowmobiles running, bring out the team, hook them up, and just in the time it takes me to hook up my team, their snowmobiles stop running again. They're just being filled with snow, like the motor compartment's just getting filled as fast as they can empty it. So we wait there, and they finally get running. We get going, and Jamie's snow machine, the steering mechanism freezes up, and then he can't turn it, and then so much snow would get in that it would just shut down, and he'd have to dig back in there and work on it again. And this happened like three or four times in the blowhole while we're trying to get out. And, you know, the cameraman comes over, because this is drama. You got to get it on the film. You know, the cameraman comes over and Jamie is like, get that beepity beep camera out of my face, you know. And, you know, and I'm trying to be a wind block and keep the wind from hitting Jamie directly while he's got exposed hands. He's down in his machine working. And after like the second or third time of that, I was like, Jamie, you know, Jeff's snow machine is still running. Drop the trailers. Let him hook onto your snow machine. You guys bug out for Gnome. And he was like, I can get this running. And I said, I know you can. I said, but you're starting to get more frostbite. Everyone else here is getting frostbite. My dogs are exposed. We've got to get moving. You can always come back for the trailers later. And he said, are you sure? I said, yes. So they hook up one of the snow machines and onto the other snow machine. They take off, and the moment they take off, Robert, I feel someone slap me on the shoulder. It's the cameraman, and I turn around, and, you know, again, we're yelling over the wind and just being blasted in the face, and he goes, my machine won't start. And our two mechanics just took off, and I'm no mechanic, and we tinkered with that thing for about half an hour. And this is when I threw a little bit of a temper tantrum. You know, I was, you know, kicking sleds and swearing and, you know, I'm ashamed to say, but, you know, I was just mad. I mean, we're so close and, you know, everything is falling apart. Just like 100 years ago, what the machines could not do, my dogs were absolutely ready to do. They were thriving in it. They were loving it. They were like, heck yeah. 100% of 100% of the team in those, they weren't giving me that the entire expedition, but when we were in those blizzards, they locked in a way that I had never seen from them before. And I was just so proud, and I was just so overcome with awe. So I flipped my sled over and start pulling stuff out. And the cameraman said, what are you doing? I was like, you're getting in the sled. And so I put him in the sled, and we start, we start mushing out. And crazy enough, the moment we hit that bridge by safety, you know, and start coming up to the safety roadhouse, the wind's gone. You know, it's still there. It's brisk, but, you know, nothing like the blowhole. And everything clears up in this beautiful sunny day. And then after a little while, the snow machiners, Jeff and Jamie, are coming back. Both machines are working great now. And because they just got them into a warm building for a little while, thawed them out. And they're going back for the trailers. And I'm like, stop. And then I point in my sled, and they see the cameraman's inside my sled. And they're like, is he okay? I'm like, yeah, he's okay, but his machine's not. So then he hopped on with them, and I mushed on to Noel.
You know, I did a serum run trip in 2020, right before COVID. And I hate snow machines. I had to pull out of that trip because of my snow machine.
Yeah.
I did not take a dog team for several reasons, but one of them was a very expensive dental bill right before. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't have gone because I'm not a snow machiner.
But you didn't want to back out.
I didn't want to back out, and I ended up having to pull out because of the same scenarios. So I feel you. When you say that story, man, I would leave a snow machine any day for a dog team. I know we're going to backtrack here and talk about crossing Norton Sound since that's a big part of the Serum Run lore. But let's talk briefly about your dogs. 16 dogs on the trail with you. Everybody thinks that the lead dog is the lead dog, you know, the holder of stories, if you will. Tell us your dogs that went on the team, and do you have a quick story or two about one or two of them?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, trying to ramp up for an expedition or an Iditarod run is harder for a purebred rare breed team like mine than it would be for someone, let's say, lives in Alaska and is running Alaskans. You know, if you've got some money, you can go buy some decent dogs in Alaska, do your qualifying races and go. Building when there's only, at the time, you know, 80, 90 Sepulas in the world, and you're trying to build up this team, it's a slow process because you're actually breeding them and then raising them. You're not just going out and buying a team. You can't. They don't exist. So every dog on this team, you know, very, very special to me in a very special way. And a lot of the dogs on this team were what you would call, in Alaska, yearlings. And so, you know, I was asking a lot from a lot of these dogs. Of course, I'll tell you about my leaders first, Druid and Vodka, my leaders. Druid is, he's a really weird dog. If you ask anyone else who comes and mushes at my kennel, they will tell you that when they first mush with Druid, they're like, what do you mean he's the best dog you've got? He's horrible. He won't lead for me. He keeps trying to turn around and go back to the kennel. But what Jamie will tell you is he'll go to wherever I am. And if I'm not on the back of that sled, Druid is like, screw that guy. You know, and
all mushers are shaking their heads here, nodding their heads, if you will, because every one of us have that dog that runs very well for us, who gives the finger to everybody else.
Yeah. And he's a one man dog, and I'm that man. And if it's anybody else back there, he doesn't give a flip. Druid is not a good command leader. He just has this forward drive that's just insane. I've never seen him get tired. Like literally, never seen him get tired. He can march at a speed that the other dogs on the team are loping, and he can just do that. He covers really good ground, and he can do it all day long. Just an exceptional dog. He's not good with commands, and he'll get something stuck in his head where he wants to go a certain way, and you know it's a battle of the wills, you know. And that's where Vodka comes in. Vodka is not as tough as Druid is. But she, if I tell her G, she'll turn right into a, you know, 10-foot snowbank if I ask her to. And so the two of them together, you know, the brain and the bronze, you know, is kind of great. So many other dogs on the team, like Jester, who's this, you know, big lug, and he's, you know, lives up to his name. He's a goofball, but he matured psychologically into a mature male and realized on this expedition about Caltag, wait, there are females in heat and I happen to be the biggest dog on this team. You know, I'm going to start usurping some dominance here. So there was that little paradigm and just a heck of a sled dog, great puller. Leif, as in Leif Erikson, is another dog that I didn't really think he's a yearling. Didn't think anything of him before this expedition. Didn't think much of him. He's Sawyer's son, the blind dog from my first expedition in the film. He's Sawyer's son and just can-do, positive, happy-go-lucky attitude no matter what's going on day after day after day. And so, you know, you just bump that dog up a little bit more and more. You know, every day you bump him up further in the line and he's bringing that positive, can-do attitude to the lead. But one of the dogs on my team, every kennel's got that scrawny dog that it's hard to keep weight on and just... her name's Juno. It's Jester's sister. Jester's the biggest dog in the kennel. Juno's the smallest female in the kennel. And I kept her from her litter not because she showed any potential at all, but because I was embarrassed to sell her because I didn't want her going out and representing my kennel in any other kennels. Like, you know, it's like, I'm not going to pass this runt off on anybody, so I guess I'm stuck with her. And she, at 10 months old, the first time I hooked her to the sled, she was leaning out, just like, you know, the stories, fabled stories of Togo. Juno will lean out and try to pass the dogs in front of her. So you move her up in line, she leans out and tries to pass. I had her in point, and when I'd give the command for the team to stop, she didn't want to stop. She tried to pass the lead dogs. I'm like, okay. And so Juno, she's, I think, 2.5 during the expedition, and she's running lead, and man, she is nothing to look at. She is a runt of a dog. She's hard to keep weight on. She's finicky, but she earned her ride on the team, you know, and really proud of her. And as far as picking the team, there are a couple choices. You know, those were the strong dogs. You also said before, you know, maybe some not so great choices. I had a couple, because I'm a breeder, and because I'm trying to propagate this breed, there were a couple dogs that were on this team because they represented a litter. And I wanted that litter represented on the team. And in hindsight, those couple dogs probably should have stayed behind. There were some neutered males that would have done better on the team if I had brought them instead of leaving them home. But I wanted as many dogs on this team to represent the future of the breed. And those neutered dogs that were back at home weren't really representing the future of the breed. So in hindsight, I would have taken a couple of those rugged males that were fixed and left a couple of those bitches at home. Yeah.
You know, a quick story that is definitely related to this. A few years ago, I flew up to Maine here and picked up a dog from you. Her name is Iselt, and it's the only Sepala we have. I've had Siberians, as we talked about in a previous episode. That's what I started with in the Iron Will days. And she's just like your dog, Juno. Kind of a scrappy, thin, goofy-looking dog, right? Not a type. Yeah. But I tell you what, the first couple of times we had her out on a team, she was doing exactly that. Let me be up here and lead. I've got the brains for this. I know what I need to do. And, you know, just a rock star.
Yeah.
But she is that goofy looking dog.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
But goofy looking.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the stout 70 pound.
Yeah. And for leaders, you don't need that. And
yeah.
That's the thing with Juno and your Iselt is if you're a leader, you just need to have that drive and that connection to the musher. And she's got that. You know?
Yep.
So she's earned her right to stay on the team. And, you know, now, I mean, I would have loved to have given her away when she was 6 months old, but now it would take a big chunk of change to buy her from me.
For sure. So let's backtrack a little bit and talk about Norton Sound. As we mentioned, this is a big part of Serum Run lore. Tell us a little bit about that briefly, so we're not here for a long time, Jonathan. What was the decision about crossing that? That's sort of that mystical spot on Iditarod Trail that a lot of people know about.
And leading up to it, now keep in mind, you know, we're doing this a month and a half before the Iditarod comes through. And I mean, before we even came to Alaska, before these unprecedented conditions, you know, that were immediate conditions, before all of that, we didn't know if we'd be able to cross Norton Sound because, you know, it's hit or miss whether or not it's even frozen up that time of year on a good year. And so then we start the expedition and, you know, everyone's, you know, saying, you know, races are being shut down. You know, the conditions are horrible. When we left, I mean, there wasn't even snow on the coast. It was frozen up, but there was no snow on the coast. And so it was a mess. And I just kept praying that, you know, the closer we got to Norton Sound, you know, the better the conditions would get. And as fate would have it, the Covenant Church in Shaktulik put us up. And Shaktulik's, I believe, where Leonard Sepala actually received the serum and turned around to go back. And in Shaktulik, we received the word the night that that we arrived, just before we crossed, that the first snowmobiles had crossed that day. And so if any snowmobiles had crossed, we were going to cross. And so we got to the edge, and it was very cold, and it was windy, but sun was shining. It was really a bright, beautiful day. We got to the edge, that little sand spit right before you actually really commit yourself to Norton Sound. And man, it was almost like the, what do they call them, the siren, you know, calling to you. You know, it was a beautiful sunny day. It was brisk. The dogs were really keen. And it was just like, come on out. Everything's going to be fine. Come on out on Norton Sound. Everything looks good. And so, yeah, let's do this. Let's go while we still have some daylight. And, you know, the conditions just as we crossed the sound just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And I've got videos of it even from my phone of crossing Norton Sound. And that was the first time where I got faced with the ice plus wind. I'd never had to deal with that before, you know, and it was gale force winds and, you know, just like sand, you know, just shooting us in the face. My dogs would take off and leave the trail at full speed. And I'd, you know, yell at them, correct them, they'd get back on. And I was wondering, like, what the heck? Why are they doing that? And this is, talk about the DNA of these dogs. Talk about their hardwiring. One of the reasons why they were leaving the trail, I got to see. And then it finally made sense to me why they kept doing this. They'd be trotting along, and then boom, everyone would turn on the afterburners, and everyone would leave the trail. And I had no idea why until they brought me to the reason. There were seal holes. And seals were popping up and down out of these seal holes. And just these primal, you know, Siberian dog traits were kicking in. And they wanted to hunt. You know, they wanted to take me to the seal holes.
So they were going off trail for the seal. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, to the seal holes. And so I had open water even before the conditions got bad. You know, you had the open water, you know, what they call the water sky. You know, I could see that off to my left and these seal holes underneath me. And so the ice wasn't, you know, was not very, very thick at all. But we were being blasted. And this was the first time I saw, and I'll wrap this up, the first time I saw that in my dogs. The sled was getting blown over. That's how strong the wind was. If I stood upright between myself and the sled, we were a sail. And we would just flip over. So I was hunkering down and leaning onto my sled, and dogs that had been giving me 60 or 70% efforts, all of them started giving 100%. And that's the moment when I was like, this is magic. You know, I'm seeing something magical take place here that I've never seen before. Like, my dogs locked in and they were, you know, like I said, like adrenaline junkies. They're like, heck yeah, let's do this. This is awesome. And it was in that moment that I realized that in this instance, I really am the weak link. You know, I'm the one feeling like I'm hanging on for dear life, and they're thriving. They're just eating this up. They're loving it. And my team said they saw me off in a distance. They saw my headlamp, and they were like, a Koyuk, right? And you know, they were like, okay, let's suit up, and, you know, so that we can guide him into town. They said by the time that they suited up and looked back out, I was pulling into town because my dogs were just moving. And I don't think it was that they were moving to get out of it. I think they were moving because in their brains, this was a lot of fun. It wasn't to me, but it was to them.
Couple of perspective type questions. Obviously, 99% of the people that listen to this have no idea what this terrain looks like. How far off of the coast are you? Could you see the coast? Could you see the villages? And is this truly, you know, ocean type topography? Give us an example of what it looked like. Yeah. For our listeners.
So we have here in Maine 20, 30 mile long lakes that I've mush across, and this is nothing like that. It's a completely different animal. And given those winds at any time, you know, especially that early in the season, that ice can break off that you're traveling on. You know, with the tide underneath rising and then coming back down, plus the winds, you know, it is a... And there were stories from Zeppelin's time of Leonard Zeppelin crossing the Bering Sea at one point before the Sirim Run. And, you know, just as you know, as Providence would have it, the wind brought his ice back to Shorefast Ice some hours later. So all of that's really, really possible. And after running the Serum Run and crossing Norton Sound, yes, you know, Disney does what Disney does, but that early in the season, crossing Norton Sound is even really different than crossing Norton Sound in March.
So how far away is land?
So I think where we crossed, it was about a 25, and I have all this in my journal, and I don't have my journal with me, but I think it was about a 25-mile crossing, and there is a point, especially with the weather I was having, where there was no land anywhere in sight at all. It started out beautiful, but by the time I was halfway out there, it was nothing but you know, some open water off to the left and seal holes.
For perspective, the land is to your right side.
Yeah.
How far off of that land are you in terms of distance? Is it a mile? Is it a half mile?
Well, it is at first, and then it just increases distance, and then it starts to close the distance as you come back in. But I think, and again, you know, I'd have to look at a map to know for sure, but I think at one point we're at least 5 miles offshore, at least, you know, when you're out in the middle of it, from the nearest land on your right, and you're 10 miles, you know, to the north of you and 10 miles to the south of you at least.
So guys listening, think about that for just a second. Compare this to Iditarod and everything that's going on with that, with marked trails and other teams in front and behind you. Here this guy is in the middle, literally in the middle of the ocean, 5 miles offshore. I would venture to guess most people that are listening have never swam 5 miles offshore, maybe in a boat, but that's a different animal. But that's a heck of a long way offshore, isn't it?
And I have to thank the town of Koyuk. That is the town after Norton Sound, right? They have one of those rotating strobe lights.
You know, like a lighthouse.
Like a lighthouse for ships and for planes. And man, I thanked God for that, because... And it was bittersweet, because you can see it for miles, you know, so you think you're closer than you are. But, you know, man, it was just having that assurance of knowing that my dogs somehow, some way know that that's the direction they need to be going in, and they're moving in the right direction. It's just, it's very encouraging.
Definitely a cool part of the story. And I know this episode is a little weird because we told a story about past Norton Sound when we talk about the blowhole, but very interesting for sure. Let's talk a little bit about leadership and expeditions here. Can you give some advice to people that are thinking about taking on a leadership role in outdoor activities? Maybe not expeditions, but they want to, you know, do 14ers in Colorado with a group of people, or do a long distance hiking trip or something. How does somebody develop that leadership skill? I know you're familiar with military and scouts and all that. What would you give somebody that's thinking about this?
I'm also a student of the golden age of exploration, and a lot of those polar explorers will tell you that the most important decision that they made was who they chose to go on those trips with them. That really is not a decision to be made lightly. If you're in a situation like we're in, 1 week link could just derail the whole expedition. It could be success or failure. Now, if you're leading a group of hikers or something like that, one person may decide, you know, that they went out, and you know, depending on how remote you are, will determine what effect that has on the rest of the team. But, you know, really choosing your team and knowing yourself and being honest with yourself. What I mean by that is, there were stages in my life where I was intimidated by, you know, being around people who, you know, were more accomplished than me and, you know, done, you know, greater things than I've done, you know, all that kind of thing. But over the course of my life, I've tried to, you know, again, with that introspection we've talked about, try to develop myself to the point to where, You know, the people that I chose for this team were better than me in their field of expertise, and not being afraid to do that, and knowing that that's going to come with, you know, some friction on the team sometime, and handling that with grace. You know, for me, money, things don't matter. You know, it's people and experiences. Things and money don't matter to me. It's you know, friendships and the experiences with my dogs, you know.
Speaking of that team aspect, I'm thinking about Everest trips. And, you know, it's not necessarily the summit. You may want a summit, but your team may not be able to, and you have to sacrifice that. Or thinking about somebody like Shackleton and those trips. And, you know, Columbus and, you know, Magellan and all those people have their team dynamics that are a big part of that. And I think a lot of people can learn from that in developing teams, for sure.
I've it's a very rigorous process, but at last year I earned my registered Maine guide license for, you know, taking groups out into, you know, the wilderness here in Maine. But, you know, with an expedition like this, everyone has to know that you know, we are in this to complete it. We're in this to finish this. And if there's any part of you that feels like that you might not want to see this to the end, you need to get out now, you know. And, you know, we actually had this conversation with a prospective team member. It's like, look, I want you here. You know, I said to this prospective team member that, you know, was committed for months before the expedition, I want you here, but we don't need you here. You know, you're welcome here, and we would like to have you as part of this team, but we don't need you. And if you have any question mark in your mind at all, I'd rather you break off now than for us to get out on the trail and in these extreme conditions, and then you surface those, you know, those concerns, you know.
Which comes up to the next question here, Jonathan, is how do you foster a positive team culture during an expedition, whether it be this one or any other?
It's important to... you know, we're talking humans right now, I presume. It's important to take that downtime with the team. You know, as a team leader, especially when you're surrounded by very competent people, it's important to make sure they feel heard, truly heard. Not, you know, just lip service, but that you're actually giving them the time, you know. And we had... Expedition 101, we had a weekend training session at my place before the expedition, and I made them a promise. I will listen to your concerns, I will listen to your counsel, and I promise I will actually take it into consideration before I make a final decision. But you, in return, you have to make a commitment to me that once I make that final decision, that you're going to give me that respect of doing whatever that is. And in return, I promise I'm going to hear you out. So I did that every day. You know, I would let people vent to me, let people, you know, tell me what went well, what didn't go well, you know, what their concerns are for tomorrow. And whenever possible, I would incorporate that into the decisions that I'd make for the next day.
I'm going to ask you about a day in the life of this in a second, because in a previous episode, you mentioned that a lot of times your work is just beginning when you get in. But did you guys do the proverbial around the campfire debrief every day, or did you do it in the morning, or how did that whole coming together as a team work out?
Dinner and breakfast was our powwow time.
Okay.
Yeah, and as you know, as a musher, I don't get to have dinner until my dogs are, the straw's out and the food's down, and, you know, I was putting coats on dogs, whether they needed it or not, you know, if we were going to be parked for any extended period of time. After you take care of the dogs, then it's human time. And, you know, man, I had such a great team. You know, by halfway through the expedition, you know, the dog care was my responsibility. But by halfway through the expedition, I'd pull into the village and Jeff or Jamie would say, hey, you know, we've got all the meat thawed out and it's, you know, ready to go into the dog soup, you know, so that right there just saved me 20 minutes, you know. And so, you know, becoming a well-oiled machine like that was great. And then we get to go in and have time and just sit down and talk. So those dinner times, those food times were breaking bread together and, you know, communing together. And I also, you know, I tried to encourage this. I wasn't super strict on it, but, you know, if we were staying in a place where there were two bedrooms, you know, and if Caleb, you know, slept in my room tonight, then I wanted Jeff or Jamie sleeping in my room with me the next night, just so that, you know, we're not having that
in group out
us and them. Yeah.
So as best as you can, Jonathan, can you give us a day in the life? Like, what time did this start in the morning? What time did it end? And maybe just a quick rundown about this is what we did.
Yeah.
And then do that from a musher's perspective. And if you can, the best of your knowledge, how was that different for the other team? You know, what time did they get up and leave, et cetera? So kind of two day in the lives.
So we all got up at the same time. And this was once we became a fine, well-oiled machine. Let's say by the time we hit the Yukon River. This is the way it would go. We'd all get up at the same time. We'd have a quick breakfast. We'd, you know, talk about the day. If I was talking to the school before I left, you know, I'd do a 1 hour thing with the school. But in general, I'd try to get on the trail 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock if I wasn't presenting at a school, sometimes as late as 9 o'clock if I was presenting at a school. Usually try to hit the trail. I'd be on the trail with my dogs and they'd help me get on the trail. They'd help me hook up the team and I'd take off because I'm the slowest, you know, mover of the team. And they usually would stay in the village until around 11. And the reason for that is they thankfully would, you know, clean up after the dogs, clean up the straw. And one of the customs we found in these villages is that their gas stations don't open until around 11. And so the guys would have to wait usually until around 11. And sometimes if they were in a nice village like Tanana with Cindy, Cindy would have lunch ready for them. So then they'd have lunch and they'd usually catch up with me, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I would take a, you know, give the dogs a break and hang out with the guys and, you know, for, you know, an hour or so. And then they'd take off to the next village. And then I'd be by myself again, you know, until I got to the next village. On a good day, usually Jamie would come out with all of his lights that he'd mounted on his snow machine, all lit up. And I'd see him and the dogs would know, okay, you know, the day's done. We're going to follow that snow machine into whatever parking spot.
What time was this usually?
It varied a lot. I mean, for example, when we got to Ruby, I got to Ruby at like 1:30 in the morning. And I thought my team had been in Ruby since 6 or 7 o'clock. And I found out that because they kept getting stuck on the Yukon, they didn't get in until almost 12. So, you know, sometimes my perception, since they're away from me and their perception of what I'm dealing with, my perception of what they were dealing with is not the same. And so they had a grueling day themselves, you know, coming into Ruby.
So then for non-mushers, you said that the stuff really happens after the end. So if you're getting in at a normal time, you know, and you're in the middle of winter, so it's dark a lot of the time. What time are you typically getting in on a normal day? And what time, what are you doing? And then what time is bed?
Yeah, like we would ideally, the team still would not make town because the trail conditions were just so bad. Even on a good day, we'd get in 7 to 9 p.m. You know, usually, like with Caltag, they had a potlatch for us. You know, or we would, you know, meet up when we reached, I think it was New Lotto, they were having a basketball tournament. So we pulled into the school and my teammates were already enjoying a basketball game while I was, you know, pulling the dogs in. And so, you know, we were able to enjoy the villages a little bit. And there was a couple villages, Manly, Tanana, and Galena, where Unalakleet, where we took a full day to just
extra day,
to spend with the school, talk with the students, speak at the local church, you know, that kind of thing.
So you sort of gave the day in the life of that. Was it about a 15, 16, 17 hour day?
7 to 7. So it was at least 12 hours every day. At least 12 hours on the trail, and it was usually closer to 15 and 16. And that's what I meant when I said I still have a lot of learning to do about my team, because I was reaching the coast. I was traveling the coast, and my dogs were still teaching me things about what their run rest cycle was, as opposed to what I wanted their run rest cycle to be.
Last question about the team schedule. I can imagine that your video guy, your photographer guy, he probably did more miles than anybody else because he was going back and forth to get coverage, right?
Yeah, actually, I think that award would probably go to Jamie and Jeff. Because they were, a lot of times there was no trail, so they were looking for trails, looking for routes, backtracking and that kind of thing. I would say, though, that Caleb generally stuck closer to me than...
That was his job.
...the snow machiner. So he would shoot off ahead, 30 or 40 minutes ahead of me, would come up to Bishop Rock, find this beautiful setting, and then wait for me to come through with the dog team and film me going by. And then he'd jet off ahead of me again. So he was kind of leapfrogging me, usually staying ahead of me until I'd catch up with him and then shooting off ahead again.
All right, a couple of dog questions before we end this episode. What efforts are being made, obviously this trip is this, to raise awareness about the importance of this breed?
I sat down in Poland Spring. I was giving a presentation last summer before the expedition, and they said, we want to make 2025 the year of Togo in Maine. And some shakers and movers, you know, here in Maine, you know, college presidents and stuff, it's a nice resort. And, you know, they're sitting down to breakfast with me. They invited me to have breakfast with them. And they said, so what do you think about making 2025 the year of Togo? And I said, well, you know, 13 states have state dogs, and Maine doesn't have a state dog yet. And so I just planted that seed with them.
This is before you left.
Before I left.
Okay.
And they ran with it, man. They got their local legislators on board. I was the public face of it, but I was not doing it. It was, you know, this, you know, David Boyer, who was the guy who was pushing it through the legislature. He's a state legislator. And Cindy Robbins, who owns Poland Spring Resort, and some, you know, the Historical Society of Maine and other people just grabbed a hold of it and just ran with it. And me being out on expedition just gave that extra leverage that they needed to make this the state dog. So it's officially now, the Cephalo-Siberian sled dog is the official breed of the state of Maine.
And didn't you do some kind of hearing or something on the way back after?
Yeah, so I had to appear via Zoom on a panel hearing about the bill. And then they had a second hearing about it, and I was home for that one. I drove down with a couple of my dogs, and we just parked right outside the hearing. And there were several senators who were not for it until they met some of my sets.
The power of sled dogs.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting. And that sort of leads right into the next question here. Is how do you see the future of the Cephalo-Siberian dog breed evolving? And I want to preface this because in previous episodes, you said there's about 100 remaining or out there. You have several of those 100, you know, in your crew. What is the future of these guys?
I keep hoping that, how can I say this? It's easier to go buy a team of Alaskan Huskies, especially if your goal is winning races. It's easier. And a lot of people, you know, have accused us of being gatekeepers, trying to keep the breed on lockdown. It's really not true. I am desperate to see a new generation come up and say, you know, we're going to take this torch. You know, there needs to be, I don't know if I'm going to be the person to do it, I hope so. There needs to be a team of Cephalos in the Iditarod. They need to run the Iditarod. That's going to be, you need a team of at least 25 dogs training for that. You know, there's Iditarod qualifiers, you know, and when you have such a small pool of dogs to pull from, it makes something like that really difficult. So I'm really hoping that the next generation is going to step up and say, yeah, we believe in this and we're going to make it happen. We also, you know, we have some policies that we've initiated in the last couple of years to ensure the genetic health of the breed that, you know, that we're working on. But mostly, the breed needs numbers right now. And so I will sell a pet Sepala, but if it's to someone who is dedicated to the preservation of the breed and is dedicated to working and improving the dogs and breeding them into the future, you know, their price is going to be a little less than if I'm selling it to a, you know, to a pet home or, you know, to someone who's not committed to the breed, because we really need people to jump on and say, you know, we're going to do what needs to be done to see this breed well into the 21st century.
I may ask this question in our What's Next episode, which is our next one, but how did this trip put you guys in the limelight in terms of a breed? Are you seeing any effects from that at all outside of the mushing community? I mean, does a lady in Louisiana know about the Sepala Siberian now because of you, or is it still kind of grassroots?
No, so Togo, the movie that you've referenced, put Sepalas back on the map. In the 90s, they enjoyed some popularity within the mushing community because they were beating Alaskan Husky teams. And I think that needs to happen again. Someone who's a racer, and I'd love to do it, but it requires a lot of breeding. You know, a lot of breeding. You need to breed a lot of dogs to have a competitive team, to build a competitive team up, you know, from breeding instead of buying them, you know. So then Togo movie came along, but sadly what happened with the Togo movie, we did get a lot of interest as a breed club about the breed after the Togo movie. But sadly what happened is there were some Siberian Husky kennels that saw an opportunity to flood the market with Siberian Huskies that they threw the label of Sepala Siberian Husky on. And so what we have now over the last few years is all these people who think they have Sepalas coming to us saying, hey, I bought this Sepala from X kennel. And I'm like, yeah, does it have purebred Sepala registration papers from the Continental Kennel Club? Nope. Do you mind if I see the pedigree? And you look at the pedigree from a kennel who is advertising Sepalas, and you look back 5, 6, 7 generations, there's not one Sepala in 7 generations on that pedigree. And so it actually hurt us instead of helping the breed, because people who would have been supporters of the breed got hoodwinked, and now they're committed to this dog and they love this dog because they bought it. And I mean, I, as the president of the breed club, I reached out to these guys. I said, you know, two things. You know, first of all, you're hurting the preservation of this breed by selling counterfeits as Sepalas. Secondly, you know, if you really want to help us, I'll help you find breeding pairs of Sepalas. We'll help you. You've got a nice kennel. You've got, you know, beautiful dogs. You've got a nice setup. If you really want to breed Sepalas and not mislead people, let me help you down that path, but please, please, please stop selling, you know, generic counterfeits as Sepalas, because all of these people who would have come on board and would have really been helping the breed into the 21st century got hoodwinked and derailed.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I've been in the dog world for over 30 years, mushing and obedience and breeding and all that. And you see that happen with every movie, whether it be the Dalmatians with 101 Dalmatians or Togo, as you mentioned, or Air Bud with Golden Retrievers, or, you know, German Shepherds with Ren 10-10 or whatever. It happens over and over. And sadly, people just want to make a buck. I mean, nowadays it's the French Bulldog with, you know, all the celebrities have those guys. Now they're the number one dog in the United States in terms of popularity. So you see that happening. And I just want to touch on this very briefly, because this is all about the awareness of the breed. What would you tell just your average dog owner who wants to get whether it be a Siberian or a Sepala or a French Bulldog or whatever. How in the world can they do their homework and make, because, you know, nowadays with the internet, and make sure that their homework is right? How would you educate them?
Right. Well, I'll use this as an example. If you've got one kennel saying, I'm selling this kind of dog, and they're not affiliated with any of the other kennels or the breed club that sells those dogs, that's a red flag. If they're not providing you pedigrees with certification that this is the dog that they say, that's a red flag. So, I mean, just do your homework. I mean, that's why there are breed clubs. You know, reach out to the breed club and ask some questions. I mean, if they're anything like our breed club, we're eager and willing to answer them and point you in the right direction. We want more people on our team, you know, helping us with. In order for this breed, the Sepala, to thrive, we need to increase their numbers. And we can't increase those numbers in our backyard. Like, we need other people signed on. We need other people that are committed to this. So, but do your homework. I mean, it's so... I had a guy call me. I'll anecdotal story. I had a guy call me and say, you know, I ran show dog Siberians, and he's veteran, you know, former Army combat veteran. I have my Siberian Huskies. They're not cutting it. So I bought a Sepala and, you know, was supposed to be a proven lead dog. He paid top dollar for a proven lead dog Sepala. And he said, the dog won't lead. It's short and stumpy. And I was like, can I see a picture of this dog? And he sent me a picture, and I was like, man, that's one of those small European show dog Siberian Huskies. That's not a Sepala. And I'm like, can I see its pedigree? Wasn't a Sepala in the pedigree for four generations. And there you have it. I mean, this guy's committed to these dogs that he owns now. He would have been a great, you know, Sepala, you know,
ambassador.
But now he's stuck with all of these dogs, you know, one of which he was hoodwinked into thinking was a Sepala leader and wasn't. So do your homework. Ask around. You know, before you buy from this kennel, ask a few of the other kennels what that kennel's reputation is, you know.
Guys, I know we got a little off track there talking about the preservation of the breed, but that's a big part of this story. That's one of the main reasons why Jonathan did this trip, is to be able to provide that backstory for these guys, because as he will say, and as I will say for him, neither one of us are getting any younger. I am over 50 and you are close. So in order to hold on to that legacy, which is the next part of this, we have to lay the groundwork. I'm sure you would agree.
Amen.
All right, guys, thank you for joining us today. We have one more episode here in this series. This is going to be a good one, because this is all about what is next and what did he and the team learn. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and tell your friends all about Jonathan and his crew and what they're doing on this expedition and after. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.